Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries.
See the people all in line, what's making them look at me? Can't imagine that their minds are thinking the same as me.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest helped shape the 70s music world. As a songwriter, he and his band dominated the UK charts. His flamboyant image characterised the glam look, and his production skills helped define the sound of the decade. He also wrote one of the definitive Christmas songs of all time. My guest on The First Time this week is Roy Wood. Born in Birmingham, as a guitarist and songwriter, he helmed the band The Move and managed to create big hits that combined a gutsy rock sound with psychedelic pop and a bizarre sense of humour. Then he co-founded ELO with Jeff Lynne, and his skills as a multi-instrumentalist and producer introduced an orchestral sound to the 70s charts. From then he formed glam rock heroes Wizard, whose first five singles were all top tens, and their classic track I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day has been a hit 12 times. And over his career he's recorded with Bo Diddley, the Beach Boys and Jimi Hendrix. All of which we discuss as we look back on the significant musical firsts of his life. But I started by asking Roy, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Ah, right. Well, the first instrument I ever played and the only instrument I ever went to lessons with was drums when I was about six.
That's very young.
Yeah, it is. Because My dad knew a guy called Sam Harris who played timpani in the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, and he was also a jazz drummer on the side kind of thing. And my sister was getting married. My dad wanted me to play at the wedding. so this guy gave me some lessons for a while, and it was all right. I did, and I played with his little band at the wedding.
What did you play? Can you remember?
I don't remember now.
Who did you want to be when you're that young, you know?
I only did that for a short while, really, and then I got into what other kids do, you know, and I've just forgot about music for a while, even though I liked it. I mean, there's always music in my house, you know.
What sort of thing was in your house? What sort of things did your folks play?
Classical music, and my brother-in-law was a jazz fan, you know, so he used to play a lot of jazz there, you know, and a big band stuff, and I was always a big fan of that. I grew up with it, really. And then the next thing, I think my dad bought me one of those chromatic harmonicas with a button on the side when I was about 11 or 12, and I learned how to play that. And I used to get, my dad was one of the, you know, the old working men's clubs, so he used to get me up with the trio playing a bloody harmonica. It's nuts. And then I didn't bother about it till I went to, when I was 12, I went to see The Shadows at Birmingham Town Hall, which I'd always loved at the time, the records they were bringing out. I went to see them at Birmingham Town Hall, and the sound was amazing, and Hank's guitar sounded like it had been dipped in Dettol, you know. It was just beautiful and really clean. Of course, there's a music shop in Birmingham. I used to keep walking past and, you know, staring at this blooming Fender that was hanging up in the window. But my dad got me a electric... Well, I was nagging him for ages, to be fair. He got me an electric guitar, and I picked it up, you know, quite easily, because I was such a fan of that and what was going on. And then within 12 months, he got me the Strat that was hanging up in the window. Him and my mum got it on the knock, you know.
You must have loved that instrument so much.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic.
So when did you fall in love with rock and roll? Who was the first rock and roll artist you were like, that's what I want to do?
I think at the time, the most popular things were the things that were playing at fairgrounds, like Little Richard and Elvis and Eddie Cochran, all those kind of things, you know. Mainly American rock and roll, you know. There wasn't a great deal going on in Britain then, to be fair. I mean, it was the light programme, wasn't it? It was orchestras playing stuff, not really classical or anything else, really, just middle-of-the-road stuff.
Light pops or whatever they called it. Yeah,
yeah. And it wasn't very awe-inspiring, really, to be fair. So I was mainly following the American stuff, and then I actually ended up in a band when I was 14.
Yeah, I've read about this. 14's very young to be in a group.
Well, the rest of the band were all 20 and 21. And they had me in because I'd studied all the Hank Marvin solos and I could play them. So they had me in for that, really, nothing else.
And that was Falcons?
That was the Falcons, yeah. And we used to play at just sort of working men's clubs and youth clubs and that kind of thing.
What's the Little Richard track we should play then?
No. They're all good, aren't they? Let's have a think for a sec. I mean, Good Golly Miss Molly's is a great one. Ah, The Girl Can't Help It. It's got to be that.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it. Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she walks by, the mean folks get in gross.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she winks an eye, the brass lights turn to toll.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
If she got a lot of what they call the mole.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
Become well done.
Can't help it, girl can't help it.
She made grandpa feel like 21.
Can't help it, the girl can't help it.
The girl can't help it, she was born to please.
Can't help it, girl can't help it.
And if I go to hell, I'm bending knees.
Can't help it.
When it came to the start of the move, did you have like, okay, this is who I want this band to be like? Yeah. Did you have a very set idea early on?
We were all playing in different local bands in Birmingham. There were a bunch of clubs we used to play at, and if we had a night off, we'd go down the club anyway and just join in and take the mick out of the other band and all that kind of stuff, throw a few tomatoes. And we just got talking. We were in different bands, got talking up by the bar and thought, yeah, that sounds good. And then we did a couple of things where we just got up and jammed, you know, at this place called the Cedar Club. And in fact, John Bonham was on drums then when we did that stuff. Yeah, and that was really good. And
I bet that was nice and quiet.
Yeah. And I'd been writing songs anyway before that, and the band that I was with, my share of the Night Riders then, and it which later became the Isle of Race when Jeff Lynne joined, they didn't really want to do original stuff. It was a bit like a human jukebox. I mean, to get work, they was just playing the top 20, you know, and I got bored with that. and I'd fallen for the songs that I wanted to do, and the guys who eventually became the move were keen to have a go at them, you know. So we went into a local recording studio, local cheapo one, and did some demos.
I was listening to Night of Fear earlier. It's a cracking first single, that.
I wanted to release the B-side called Disturbance because it was more in keeping with what the move were live, more rocky, and Night of Fear wasn't at all like that. But I suppose at the end of the day, the record company were right in doing that because it was more commercial. So there you go.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Fire.
That was Fire Brigade by The Move, a top three hit from February 1968, featuring my guest on the first time this week, Mr. Roy Wood. One of a number of big hits for The Move, which also included Flowers in the Rain, which was the very first song played on Radio 1 when it launched in 1967. The band sort of picked up this momentum, and you could feel, obviously, sort of Blackberry yeah. Way, then when it became your first number one. I mean, could you... Yeah. Must have been a really exciting time seeing other bands kind of all coming up through the ranks and yeah. kind of being part of a movement, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the time, we had quite a lot of top 10 records, you know. Mm. I mean, Flowers in the Rain, Fire Brigade and all them, they're all top five, you know.
So you say it really casually, like, yeah, you know. Yeah,
so we were doing all right, yeah. We did an album. I had some songs that needed more than just a four-piece band, you know. And I had some ideas for some orchestrations. And I got friendly with Tony Visconti, who could actually write orchestrations. He was good at it. And so I got friendly with him and we did a couple of tracks on a Move album with an orchestra. You know, I was sitting there thinking, I love this. This is what I really want to do, you know. I mean, and why not try and put a band together? There must be young people who play, you know, classical instruments that want to do it, want to go out on tour. Why not advertise for a cellist or a French horn player and instead of a guitarist? And I had that idea, you know, a long time back. And then I ended up with a folder full of material for it. And I was getting to a point where I thought The Move had gone, had done it, you know, as far as it could go, really. And I wanted to do this thing. And I got talking to Jeff, because we were both Birmingham City supporters. And we used to go down there occasionally, just, you know, the old story, Birmingham nil, it always was. And so we used to go and drown our sorrows. And then I told Jeff about it, and he said, oh, well, you know, fancy a bit of that. So we got the idea together, and, you know, there you go, went for it.
Instruments to focus in on, the cello being that.
Yeah.
It's got texture, it's got depth, it's really, and it became.
Well, I'd only just started playing cello then. We had a contract to do two more Move albums, so Jeff joined the Move towards the end so we could be under the same umbrella, you know. A couple of tracks on there that I bought a cheap Chinese cello, and we'd sounded all right, actually, to be fair. And we were doing a track that was going to be a Move track. Jeff came up with an idea for something, and I stuck a load of cellos on, about 15 or 16 of these three things, and it sounded like, I don't know, I wanted it to sound slightly different to an orchestra, a bit more I'm the Morrissey kind of sound, you know, but not that, you know, but just a bit more rock and roll. And it came out really good, and that was the beginning of VLO, really, that the sound of that record is 105.3A.
That was the brilliant 10538 Overture, the very first single by the Electric Light Orchestra from their first album from 1972.
Is that when you started to really get into the studio, really think about production, really think about what you could do? Because it seemed, you know, that's obviously one of the great passions of yours has been production.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to someone the other day about this. I remember we went into Phonogram Studios, and of course, a lot of the gear there was made by Philips, who were ahead of the time at that time. And that they had a recording, a mixing desk with faders on it that had got like gear knobs on it. And me and Jeff did a mix of 10538 in quad, and with the cellos whizzing around the room, and everything is fabulous. And, you know, I mean, I thought everything was going to move towards that, you know, from stereo to that and get bigger, like cinema sound and everything. And if you told me then that what people do now is just play it on a little phone and chuck it in the corner and don't bother, you know, I wouldn't have believed it.
We're talking about production. Let's talk about Phil Spector. Can you remember first hearing that sound he produced and feeling like this is, how does he do that? I want to do that.
My sort of production skills in that respect came from when I got Wizard together, was the actual lineup, because we got two drummers, two cellists. It was just like a really odd lineup. And I thought, what the hell can I do with that, you know? And the first thing I thought of with having all the drums and that was Spector. And we went down to Abbey Road Studios and we did the backing track then to Baby Drive and Ballpark Incident.
What's the Phil Spector produced track we should play at this point?
Ooh, no. You know, the Ronettes, I think. Baby, I Love You. I think the Ronettes, gotta be.
Guest on the first time today is multi-instrumentalist and producer and singer and guitarist Roy Wood.
Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
Hello, Mr. Radio. Your friendly station. So glad of your company.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is from The Move, ELO and Wizard, Mr. Roy Wood.
With ELO, it took us a while to get the band together, because it was so different then, you know, and it did take some time to get the right people. But then getting Wizard together, I didn't want to take too long over it, so I just jumped in feet first, really, and I got this phone call saying, oh, there's a big rock and roll concert at Wembley Stadium, and who was on was Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bill Haley,
legend,
yeah, Bo Diddley, all the big ones were all on it, and I said, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, put the phone down. I forgot about the fact that I hadn't got a band. You know. So I had to get them together pretty damn quick. And I remember we'd got a couple of saxophone players in, only just a few days before the gig. And of course, we didn't know the songs that well. They were like new songs that we were doing. we wrote the music out to the sax players, and they didn't want to look too obvious, so they put them on the floor on the stage, and they were playing from that. Then the wind gunner was blowing them around, following this music around in the air. You know, it was funny. So on the night after we'd done that, that was the first gig we ever did, Wembley Stadium, and it was bloody packed. You know, on the night, then we went to Abbey Road and started recording Ballpark the same night. Yeah.
That's why that track sounds really vibey, isn't it?
Yeah, probably, yeah, yeah.
Wizard Brew is a record that, it's funny, some records pick up respect and popularity as time kind of goes by.
And that never did.
And that that has now. People sort of look back at it going, being such a forward-thinking...
It was then, yeah.
...progressive record. Do you remember it sort of coming out and thinking, this is going to blow people's minds, and people just going, well, I've got no idea how to take
this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The thing is... how can I explain this? I'd always been, in people's eyes, a pop writer, and in the eyes of the management too, and they wanted me just to write some more pop songs and, you know, have some more singles out, really. But I'd always got this, especially starting to play with people in the band who were and that jazzers, you know, like the sax players and that. I got influenced quite a lot by them with, you know, playing alternative chords and this, all this, that and the other. And I thought, yeah, that's all right, isn't it? I started bringing all that into my writing, you know, which was probably on the first album, some of that going on. And I don't think people knew how to take it sort of from me, if you know what I mean.
But, you know, as I say, now it's got a reputation as being like a very progressive, forward-thinking, ahead of its time record.
Yeah. Well, thanks, everybody. It took you long enough.
Can you remember people's reaction when you first started to wear the makeup, the glitter and the whole thing? Did it freak people out a little bit?
Oh, well, what happened with that? That stemmed from the end of the move. We had a record out called Brontosaurus. And I got this girl to make me a long jacket out of triangular shaped material so that it looked like scales, like animal scales, if you know what I mean. And it was one triangle black, one white, one black, one, all over. The rest of the band went to the bar, and it was the first time I'd been on TV as just the front singer person. I was sort of looking at myself in the mirror, and the jacket was glaringly jacket, and I was sort of lost in the, you know what I mean, in the jacket.
I'm being upstaged by a coat.
Upstaged by a coat. So I went to the makeup department, and I got some black and white makeup, and I made my face up to match the coat.
All right.
That's what it was.
I see.
And then I think I put a star on the forehead and all that, and I combed my hair out a bit wild, and it went down, you know, pretty well. I heard a story that John Lennon actually phoned somebody up and said, "You've got to see this." And it was me rolling around the stage, biting the heads off guitars and that, you know. As far as the makeup goes, after we'd done the ELO thing and went into Wizard with the name A Wizard, I thought it would be nice to bring that back, but more sort of multicoloured, you know, and that's all I did.
Do you think it served as, I don't know, not a disguise, but a kind of way, like a mask of sort of keeping a bit of distance from, because you've got your image and then you.
Yeah.
Was it quite useful like that?
Sometimes. I do remember having no time to get changed, and we were doing two TV shows, and the pilot's on the train, and I was in full garb, and it didn't go down too well with the older folks, I don't think.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
When I do this show, there's often, like, if the artist I'm speaking to is fortunate enough to have three or four, I don't know, maybe even just one of those really big songs that kind of means so much to people. And Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day is one of those songs. It's part of culture. And sometimes people, sometimes musicians are like, yeah, you know, I'm sick of it. Other people are like, you know, well, I don't have a relationship. Other people are like, I still love it. What's your relationship like with that song?
With the Christmas song?
Yeah.
It's all right, actually, because...
it's a complex thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons it was a hit as well is because we had so much fun recording the thing. Yeah. You know, we really had a laugh doing it. And it comes out, I think, on the record somehow. And it's one of them. I mean, I never play my own stuff at home ever, unless it's like a new song that I'm working on, obviously. And but if I hear it on the radio at Christmas, I don't rush to turn it off, which I don't know. I don't know if that sums up your question or not, really.
I think that's a pretty good answer, yeah, because it is, you know, there's it's a wonderful compliment to think, regardless of anything, my song comes back and people love it. People don't get sick of it. People still love listening to it. The other part, it's like, and the other, you know,
yeah,
helps financially to have one of those, but also part of it's got to be kind of like, here we go again.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
I guess is it a double-edged sword?
And it makes you think. It's a great honour, really, when it comes out at Christmas, and it's on the same album as Bing Crosby's White Christmas, you know, so
exactly.
It must be all right. Don't you lock the doors, you know the treats and it costs on the way.
Let's talk about the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
So, if we're talking about production, we're talking about voices. When did you first fall in love with the Beach Boys?
They'd always be my favourite band ever. If you're talking to Jeff Lynne, I think his favourite band was always the Beatles, you know, in the early days. And mine was always the Beach Boys. I just loved the harmonies and the fact that I'd actually heard them singing stuff. It's a bit like the Four Freshmen, you know, rather than the surfing stuff. Mm. And they were very, very good at it. And I was a big fan of that. I actually worked with them, which is great. I can explain this. Probably around, it was the mid-70s, Wizard had just broken up, probably 76, 77, something like that. And I was over in LA doing some radio interviews and that, trying to start something new, you know, going on. And I'd just gone with Warner Brothers, Brother Records, I think, the Beach Boys label was with them as well. A woman came along to a couple of the interviews and knew I was a big fan and said, oh, they're doing some recordings soon, because Brian Wilson hadn't been with them for a long time, but unbeknownst to the fans and that, they were doing a secret album with him on it. I was half asleep in my hotel room and the phone went, and I said, hello, hi Roy, it's Brian. And it's Brian Wilson on the other end of the phone. I nearly fainted. So anyway, he invited me along to this session, Brother Studios, and got there a little bit late, actually, because I'd been off doing interviews and this, that and the other. So when we arrived, they were just coming out and they were getting into a big old black bulbous gangster looking car. He came up, shook my hand, and says, hey, do you like this? I opened the doors of the car, this track came out. Beach Boys track. And I went, yeah, I think so. And he says, OK, everybody back in the studio. They were locking up, and they went back in. And he said, oh, I want to do this intro, we want something first. And can you imagine this, me being such a massive fan of them? I'd only been there, like, half an hour, and I met Brian Wilson and Carl Wilson and, you know, all my favourite people ever. And I was standing there, singing on a mic, with Brian Wilson just opposite me and Carl Wilson at the side. And we were singing these harmonies together. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was just fantastic. Did that, and I ended up playing a little bit of saxophone on the end of one of the tracks called It's OK. It was on an album called 15 Big Ones at Beach Boys. So I was well chuffed about that.
What's the Beach Boys track we should play now? Anything you want?
Oh, man, there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
My favourite is one I've actually recorded on my new album called Breakaway. So I wouldn't mind doing that one.
Change the part of me that has to be free.
Did you feel as the 70s turned into the 80s, because pop music's always moving, always changing, could you feel there was a point you were like, okay, I'm going to move away from this kind of arena and the pop hits are going to start changing? Because that's a difficult shift, isn't it? Because it's what happens in pop music.
Yes.
Did you find it tough?
The thing that I found a bit tough, I don't know when it was, but it's when the focus went off music and more into fashion. And if you weren't fashionable, you didn't get hits anymore, you know, which was wrong, totally wrong. Unless you were around all the time, say someone like Tom Jones did, because he'd always been there and he had such a big following, you know. But we were all left in the dust for a while, I think. But fortunately, I mean, I do a lot of recording and that anyway, so I've got another, so I don't have to rely on just being a singer and stuff.
Mm. It must be lovely to also get to a point in your career where, like, you get recognised for this whole legacy, this body of work, That must feel fantastic.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's really, really good.
Touching on the classical passions that you have and always have had, Nigel Kennedy.
Yes, big mate of mine. He's a great bloke. And as far as I'm concerned, the best living musician on this planet, I think.
When did you first meet?
We met at a football match, of all things, because he's a big Villa supporter. And, of course, I'm a Blue Nose. He used to shout at me from across the room and we used to take the mick out of each other. We didn't know each other. It was one of the times when the two teams were playing each other and went down. And I was talking to him in the bar. This was ages ago now, a few years ago. Got on really well with him. And he's a smashing bloke. We were talking about this, that and the other. And I said, oh, I'm doing the Symphony Hall in Birmingham soon. I don't suppose you fancy coming along and having a bit of a scrape. And he said, yeah, man, I'll do it. You know. And I thought, yeah, he probably won't really. And he asked me to send him the chord charts and everything, which I did. And then I didn't hear from him. And then on the day, we were having a rehearsal. And he bowled up with a violin under each arm. He says, yeah, I'm here. Where do you want me? And I wanted him to play on Blackberry Way, which we do at the end, just before the Christmas thing. He hadn't told me. He'd done an arrangement of J.S. Bach meets Blackberry Way. I said, well, do a little bit a cappella on your own, bit of violin. I said, the audience will love that. And then give me the nod when you want me to come and sing it. Thank you very much. So he started this thing. He was amazing, absolutely amazing. By the time he gave me the nod to come in singing, I backed off so far from the mic. I had tears in my eyes. It was that good.
And how's the new record sounding? Tell me about it. Are you pleased? Are you happy?
It's all right, yeah. Obviously, because we've got all these gigs, I won't be going back in the studio until after Christmas, I don't think. I've only ever really recorded my own material, as you know, but I thought to try and get an album out quicker, why not do some covers, you know? But I had to think carefully about it, because I'm a bit picky, you know, when it comes to other people's songs, to be fair. Maybe I shouldn't be. And I was trawling through things that would suit the tone of my voice, you know. The ones that came out were mainly American songs, you know, so I'm going to call it Roy Wood's American Jukebox. I want to do them in a way so it just doesn't sound like a cover of the song, you know, do them in a slightly different way, otherwise there's no point really doing it.
What's the last song we should play? It can be anything you want. We'll finish on
Oh God, blimey. You'll have this in the BBC archives.
Good start.
Okay, there was a composer from the 50s and 60s called Robert Farnon. Who's a Canadian who had his own orchestra. And he used to write a lot of the themes for the old BBC programmes, like In Town Tonight, all these kind of things. And he wrote one, which was one of the cleverest bits of music I've ever heard, called Jumping Bean. And it'll be by Robert Farnon and his orchestra. You try and find that.
We'll find it and play it. Good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Is a repeat.
Right now, it's the Six Music Jukebox.